Check, check, check. Awadamaserv. Ladies and gentlemen, we are back. Welcome to Chatting Between Takes. I am a day late and dollars short. I was supposed to record this yesterday. It's Sunday, 5 o'clock my time. I don't know when you're listening, but man, it's a nice day out. It was a little gray for a sec. You know, I couldn't record yesterday because my spring-summer conscience wouldn't allow it. Oh my God, it was such a nice day. I don't even totally remember what I did. But it included getting a new stylus for my record player, because somehow in moving our... We do a sort of spring decorating. Emily and I do this... We sort of shuffle the furniture around for every season. And man, is it nice, because it makes the home feel like just different, really. You know, it's a new home, even though it's the same home. So it has all the familiarity, but it's got this... freshness to it. And we do a spring cleaning and the whole thing. And somehow moving my record player, I didn't lock down the tone arm and broke off the needle. So I've been reading this book lately, and I really, really recommend the book. If not, well, okay, I'm only like four chapters in. So a third way through. It's called Shop Class as Soul Craft. Now, I'm not going to give the whole book away. I really do recommend reading it. Does anyone remember reading? As if I've read anything other than a magazine in about 10 years. So this one is basically talking about this idea of, you know, working with our hands. And, you know, this guy basically was working in a think tank and making a lot of money. And he quit after a short period and was just thinking to himself, I haven't produced anything of value since I started this job. And I get that. I mean, I really get that. I work as an artist. Now, I do believe in the inherent value of what I'm doing. And I also feel that there's an inherent value in honoring ourselves as, you know, career folk. I'm sure there's way nobler ways to live, but I give as much as I can. I always try and leave a little more gas in the tank than when I borrowed the car. And I think that the sort of gift of entertainment, I know, because in my own life, it has utterly changed and gotten me through hard times, and that's worth something. So I get that, and I get the desire to be able to provide for a family and all that kind of thing, or oneself, by the way. I'm a single man, technically, i.e. not married, and don't have kids.
That I know of, I will find you, and I will kill you.
Wow, that was really bad. That's the worst we've done yet.
If you want money, I don't...
Wow. Yes, I've been watching too much Game of Thrones, and then since Liam Neeson did the Game of Thrones musical narration, I've sort of blended the Irish in about 9 versions of British. But yeah, so...
I will find you, and I will kill you.
Providing for oneself is, you know... something that maybe we don't do enough of. Side note here. I remember once a friend of mine was having a kid, and he said, I am never going to treat my kid the way my dad treated me. And it was said with a fair bit of aggression and like, yeah. And I remember thinking to myself, that's great. But it's still on the push-pull spectrum of the tug of war of, you know, ultimately, I'm going to resent my kid if I think that way, because my kid now owes me knowing that I had it worse than them. So what I remember saying to my friend is, right, but I think, and I'm not a parent, although he wasn't at that time either, I think you might be missing a key link in that chain, and that link is, I will never treat myself the way my parent treated me. And that, in my own life, is one of those ways to, you know, I've learned how to gift myself treating myself. Anyways, blah, blah, blah. I was out the other day getting this stylus yesterday when I was supposed to be recording this. And so this bookshop class of Soulcraft talks about, you know, producing versus just an economy of information. And what's interesting for me is that just by changing the needle on a record player, which I'd never done, so it's so easy. I mean, it's a joke how easy it is. Excuse me. So easy, And I felt so satisfied and accomplished after I did it. And I've changed suspension on a Porsche or, swapped out seats and drilled holes in the subframe to put in custom seats. I don't do a lot of the electronics or the internals, but, you know, anything that's sort of wrenching, I'm pretty good at, especially on my motorbike. Never changed a stylus. And instead of just going, oh, fuck, I don't know how this works, I was like, okay, let's figure out how this works. And it was very satisfying. And the one thing this book talks about a lot is how much thought and intelligence is actually required for what we have termed blue-collar labor. So we've kind of fallen into this idea that if you work in the trades, it's noble, but it's not a smart man's game. And the guy's example that's pretty great, because he ended up opening a motorcycle shop, is, you know, when things don't go according to the manual, you're just working on the fly. Or, by the way, as I talk about a lot, you have to go to somebody who knows more than you do and go, hey, what would you do in this situation? And then he talks about, you know, how you have to circle the bike maybe for an hour or two until you're finally ready to do the work that no manual has in it, because you departed from the manual when the bolt sheared off or whatever. I get that. I get that, having done that kind of work. And I really truly believe it, that these functional things we do, because we're so fucking lame with our smartphones. I mean, oh, you know, when somebody who I've sent an address to will text me back from their iPhone and go, where is it? I just want to be like, what the fuck are you even asking me? You're typing to me from the device that tells you where it is. How is it easier for you to ask me where it is than to just hit the highlighted blue thing that will open the other thing that will point where you are and where you have to go? You don't even have to read a map anymore. So this is my thing. I love my smartphone and all that stuff. I love what it can do, but I'm always fighting my relationship with it because it's A, addictive, and B, lazy making. And I'm not a conspiracy theorist at all, but Instagram guys are making $1 billion while I'm staring at stupid fucking photos, not earning or stimulating or doing anything. How great would it be if even your unborn potential competition for whatever it is you do, let's say I'm going for an acting audition, and everybody I'm auditioning against, let's say, is too busy staring at a fucking thing in their hand to learn their lines or to go live a life that might bring an interesting perspective to the work. I'd be real happy about that. Now, I'm not saying we all should go out and be like Instagram competitors or invent a new Facebook, but we're not gonna, because we're on Instagram and Facebook. Again, there's the 3% who are gonna use those platforms to catapult themselves into $1 billion. For the rest of us, we're just giving up our lives if we spend too much time engaged in that stuff. Most of you maybe aren't. I sometimes feel like I am. And I have this real sway with working my ass off and then being lazy and staring at screens. So when I look at this stuff, like how to actually just do simple manual tasks, it's so exciting. And that's something I've been spending the last little while doing, even with my old car, you know, is just getting certain things sorted on it. And it feels so nice to just unscrew a headlight, check that all the contacts are good, screw it back in. No major thing happened, but man, do I feel like I've actually spent time doing something. So I was thinking about this. I was chatting with a friend who was thinking about taking the acting class I teach. And I was like, yeah, you know, I think you'd really benefit. I think everyone would. Otherwise, I wouldn't teach the way I teach. And the one thing I said is, you know, we get good at what we do. So that one's kind of obvious. That's the whole, you know, you got an evil dog and a good dog in your garden. Which one grows? The one you feed. So we all know that. That's pretty straightforward. So whatever we do is what we get good at. So that's what I was suggesting to this person. And the other thing, though, and this is where it gets interesting for me, we're thinking about, is it's not just what I do, it's how I do. And I don't mean how well I do, I mean how I do. Because if happiness is not a destination but a way of traveling, let's assume that's true. I buy that. I'll be happy when? Uh-uh, not gonna happen. Are you happy now? If you can't be happy now, why would something else give you anything more than a boost, and let's assume your household income's more than 70,000 grand, and if you're in your 20s, who gives a shit? You don't need it. You don't need an income at all. I don't know. Maybe. I don't know. Maybe that's true for any age. But I do like the idea of a family, and I don't like the idea of raising a kid in a shitty environment where you can't afford music lessons for them. So, you know, people do it, and people do it well, and those kids will have advantages I didn't have. But I'd rather give my kid music lessons. So, you know what I'm saying. If I'm in my 20s, though, who gives a fuck? If I'm starting to think about settling a little, then I wouldn't mind a little more stability. The point is that 70 grand number is like a, it's been proven scientifically, I don't know how scientifically we can get about happiness, that 70 grand is the cutoff. So if you have less than 70 grand, yeah, more money might make you happy. You're working too hard on the Maslow's hierarchy to even get ahead to actually enjoy an evening sitting with your family or with your lover or whatever. But over 70 grand, it doesn't make a difference if you have 120 grand or 180 grand. I buy that. I personally buy that. And when I have friends who feel like more money is the answer, it's usually because they're mismanaging the money they have. I know because I did it. And thinking more money, it's just going into a hole, right? Like it's you're bailing out a leaking boat and your bailer's too small. So you can't plug that hole with more water. That's not a good analogy. That's not a good analogy. Your reasoning's all wrong. And this is going sideways fast. So it's not just what you do. It's how you do it. Here's my example on this. Let's say I'm like, hey, I really like interacting with other people. So this on paper seems like a really positive thing. It seems like, yeah, I like to get out and interact. But how am I interacting? Do I need to win all my interactions? Do I need to be the funniest guy in the room? Or do I need to insert myself? If somebody's telling a story, do I need to add how I fit in it so everybody knows I was there? You know, so now what I'm starting to do is maybe be a little overbearing or controlling in my interactions. So now what I'm actually getting good at isn't interacting necessarily. I'm getting good at being overbearing. I'm getting good at speaking when it's maybe someone else's turn. I'm getting good at boosting my ego when I should maybe be working on humility or listening or maybe not even be in that conversation. But if I am functioning off of, oh, and here we go, Jesus, I've been seeing my therapist a bit since we last chatted. If I'm functioning off a childhood habituation where I always need to like, then I basically am not interacting and I'm just getting better at being a big, immature kid with adults. And for me, I always go, how's that working for you? How's that working for me? And I know that it's funny, I was sitting with my therapist and, you know, life's going pretty well for me. And when I say well for me, I haven't booked any grand new job, nothing we haven't already talked about. But fuck am I loving the spring? Fuck am I learning how to enjoy my days off? Fuck am I actually learning how to sit in my own skin, even when Emily's away, and just enjoy my day? Today's another example of that. I did work today. I got up at 4 a.m. to work, but had a nice big nap after, had a few coffees, and I'm enjoying my evening in a way that is me alone right now, chatting with you guys, but after this, I'll just chill out for a bit and maybe take the motorbike out, probably not, maybe watch some Mad Men, probably do that. The reason I'm getting better at this is that I'm chilling with my therapist and he's sort of like, why are you here? Things seem to be going well for you. And for me, again, it always comes back to that childhood habituation. What do I keep forcing? And I don't know what it is, by the way. That's why I'm there. Sometimes we do know what it is. And the worst thing is when we know what it is and we keep doing it. If I know I'm being an asshole, fucking stop. Just stop. You know, and this is a tough one with my parents because the way I interact with my parents is that I love them and I want to have a relationship with them. And without getting too specific, because I think some things should be private, it's hard. Right now, it's hard for me to have the relationship I want going to visit my folks in my childhood home. It's a real struggle for me. And so what I have to learn how to do is not do what I always do. Let's assume they're not going to change. 86 and 76 years old. Let's just assume that they're not going to change much. So if I go and I just replicate my childhood dynamic, hey, we're better to do it than in the fucking house I grew up in. You want to talk about habituation? How about I go insert myself in their dynamic some more? I've worked so hard not to replicate it, which is why Emily and I get along so damn well, at least on my side of the street. Her side of the street, I don't know how she's so gracious and fantastic. I really don't. I'm not just complimenting my girlfriend. I don't know how this young girl is so present and aware of things that I had to give up my life, financially, business-wise, almost die, sever many relationships, just to find an ability to be with someone else in a way that wasn't an aggro version of my childhood. Woo! And we all have childhoods, right? Like, mine wasn't worse than yours. It just wasn't. Like, somebody out there is like, no, that sounds worse, or whatever. Yours was way worse. That's the point. We all have our childhoods and we all have our stuff. Are we functioning on an aggro, like, steroidal adult version? Because the one thing we have as adults is reasoning. And the one thing reasoning can do for us, or for me anyways, is let me justify anything. And usually, where my justification runs deepest is when I know I shouldn't or don't want to be doing something, but that ego slash childhood slash fear kicks in and starts running the show. And you know, I was working with someone on this, and I think my greatest fear could be, well, I have two. It's also my greatest desire. So this is number one, my greatest fear and desire is that I'll be seen. I want nothing more than to be seen. Nothing more. You know, that to me is it, right? We're all fighting to be seen. But I'm also afraid of nothing more than to actually be seen. And then the other fear, and this is where I think a lot of dishonesty, a lot of weirdness kicks in, is the fear of missing something. Why would I be sitting with Emily at dinner checking Instagram? Seriously. What the fuck is that? There's no one prettier on Instagram. There's no one who dresses better. There's no one cooler. Oh, because Emily is already giving me 100 likes by being at dinner with me. But I need 101 because I'm that fucking... And by the way, if you think I'm talking to you, I'm talking to me. You may relate. But my need for likes. So I always joke about these girls who, you know, they'll start out with photos of their dog and their boyfriend and their mom and their dad. And then there's the trip to Cancun where they have the great cleavage. 30 likes goes to 300. Now you get the cleavage shot every 3 days. And eventually they're just Instagram bikini models. And there's no person there anymore. Yes, and I'd love to say, but for the grace of God, there go I, but I found myself a few weeks ago, and it's interesting, by the way, because a few weeks ago, I was in the middle of a hit run of a hit play, first play I've done in 14 years, what a brilliant experience, I want to talk about that in a sec, I'm working on this TV show still, The Girlfriend Experience, I have one more day next week. Our film is now premiering in Los Angeles. If you're listening, June 2nd at 7:15 p.m. at Grauman's Chinese Theater, Barn Weddings playing. I don't want to speak specifics. Bottom line is, at the very least in Canada, you can see this in the theater next year. It's happening. Why have I posted so many damn selfies lately? I'll tell you why. Because I'm starting to get fans as well as friends following me. And my like count doubles if I post the right selfie. And I was looking going, dude, you might not be a bikini model, but you are that thing. And I really believe if you spot it, you got it. Hey, take this one, folks. If you're getting real mad at somebody for being a certain way, and it's usually someone maybe close to you, that person's always taking advantage. Well, maybe you're taking advantage. That person always, I don't know what. I just know in my life, when I spot it, I got it. And because I think I'm self-aware, I'll tell you for a month that, well, that doesn't apply to me in that situation. And then I'll crash when I realize it does. And the only grace I think I get is that I've crashed enough times that while picking the, you know, like when you're a kid and you're running and you run too fast because your little legs can't keep up with the weight of your head. And you get all the gravel in your hand and your knee. As I'm picking that out and going, damn, that happened again. it's like, okay, but at least now I can step back 3 more feet to see what I tripped on. So next time I'm still going to trip on it, but maybe won't fall as much. Only need 2 Band-Aids the next time. But that fear of missing something is huge. So not just what I do, how I do. And I believe the how I do is more important, by the way. The how I do is where I'm going to get good at how I do it. So how am I approaching things? I don't know, but I know how I'm trying to. And that seems to be working as more people want to work with me, not less, than compared to, let's say, my 20s. The needle's moving in the right direction. You know, I've nicknamed this the summer of heat. That's fucking brilliant, Sean.
Well, that's brilliant. I will find you, and I will kill you.
The summer of heat. Now, the reason I call it the summer of heat is because I want to dig in this summer. I'm so excited to dig in this summer. And by dig in, I mean this. I have become a guy who prefers the shade to the sun. I don't know when this happened, because I remember even when I was 28, I moved to Los Angeles, and I just wanted to sit on the sunny patio every day. Went to the beach every day. Then I basically started to disappear into, you know, dark rooms and late nights, and emerged from that at age 32. And, you know, I started to prefer the shade on a sunny day. And this summer I want to, it's not about going and getting skin cancer. It's about enjoying that sweaty feeling at night when the place just won't cool down enough. Enjoying that 10 p.m. when it's sticky. You know, kind of dig it. Maybe I was watching Bloodline and I'm thinking about Miami and the Keys and all that. And I'm going, I wouldn't mind a little of that in my life right now. I don't know what that means. I don't know where that fits. But I know that I feel I've been delicate. You know, I tore a hip, slight labral tear last year. It's just about bang on, knock wood, by the way. But I'm starting to do lots of stuff where I don't feel it the next day. So even in recovery, I've been feeling the hip the next day. And I've always kind of got some component of my body sore. So I've, rightly so, because I had a legitimate injury there that needed physio to recover from, I was sort of being a little more delicate's not the word, because I was still digging in and doing squats and fighting and karate and all that. But like putting a bit of a shell, which actually created a bit of a tension. That's kind of why I want the summer heat. I want to melt that away. I want to get to that core where it's just like, ugh. You know, I want it to get all Jessica Lange circa 1978 up in here. Was Jessica Lange in a hot movie? Was she in Body Heat? Oh my God, I should know this. I don't know this. Question for Chatting Between Takes. Dennis Alexander Nicholson, love this question, and this kind of segues into the film stuff. What are your thoughts on film festival in today's film industry market? Great question, Dennis. The problem with it is that you can answer this better than I can, because you've had way more films at festivals than I have. We're just playing our second festival, and then right after that, we're doing the Oakville Film Festival. So we got 3 festivals under our belt as of mid-June. I will say this, Dennis. You know, we already have been offered distribution on one end. We already have some really great response just by virtue of, I don't know, the best way I can put it is this. My star meter went up 10,000 the week Barn Wedding was announced, because it says director Sean Benson all over. All of our star meters jumped. Emily's combined with Crimson Peak, she's up fucking went up 22,000 or whatever. Now, this is just, if you don't know, the star meter's on IMDb, and it's basically where you're trending within the business. And I mean, one week I can be 2,000 and the next week 20,000. And somebody who's on, you know, I don't know, something crappy but popular that week because it does something. But generally speaking, you know, it's weighted in the right direction. So the buzz from these festivals is really helpful. And since a lot of the industry is about buzz, I do think the festivals help with industry and help with taking the film to market. What we did in Canada with the film at the Canadian Film Festival, and here's what we did, people listening. We got into a festival and chose, because, you know, you can turn down a festival if you want to be tactical in another direction. We chose to be a big fish in a smaller pond. TIFF's a bigger festival. I don't even know what other Canadian festivals are bigger, but we had our world premiere in our hometown at the Canadian Film Festival. Now, the Canadian Film Festival was brilliant. It was one of the best experiences of my life, but it doesn't have 90 films or, you know, features from around the globe playing. I think it's got 10 or something. I don't remember. It was the best choice we could have made. Because what we did was we launched this thing right. Sold out house, all that stuff. I've talked about that too much. But in any case, Dennis, the Dances with Films, you know, we've already been talked about in IndieWire. We've been talked about in Variety. We've been approached by a lot of people. The film itself has climbed the charts. And there's anticipation to see it. All I can tell you is that, you know, with my experience with this, these festivals are fantastic. Like, fantastic. Every distributor we've talked to, by the way, or people who've had films distributed are like, dude, get in Sudbury Film Fest, get in the Akron Film Fest, get those laurels. Because a lot of it is, there's so much content out there, right? Dennis, like every year, the amount of content increases as the ease of creating content, not necessarily good content, by the way, but we can all just shoot a movie on our iPhones. And that means that there's probably 1,000 times more movies being made this year than 10 years ago. I bet you that's an underestimation. So the distributors and their sales reps and all these people, they are not sure what to watch. So the idea that a festival's chosen you already winnows you down. So when 100 people send a distributor their film and 10 of those films get accepted into whatever film fest, the distributor can kind of go, cool, I'm just going to watch those 10. Somebody else already went through those for me. And this is something I was told by a distributor. So, I mean, for me, the goal is not... For me, the goal is always financial, Dennis. If this movie makes money, making our next is easy. And if this movie gets distributed, making the money is easy. Or, you know, recoupment at very least, even if it's not a hit. And even then, recoupment of hard costs, which, you know, we got a lot of favors on this thing. So even that's still a massive win because we're in theaters and we're on iTunes and airplanes and all that kind of thing. I wholly have been loving the film festival thing. The only thing I'll say is this, Dennis, and this is just me, and I could change my mind. I'm not going to spend a year chasing the next festival, the next festival, the next festival. This movie's excellent. It's done. It's already got one win, two wins, three wins under its belt. And for me, by wins, I mean in terms of it already exceeding where I kind of expected it to go. Maybe that's not true. And more to come. But I don't want to, in a year, still be lugging this around going, I don't want to get that attached to it, if that makes sense. It's, you know, I want to sell it and move on, quite truly. So that's where I'm not going to make sure there's 1,000 laurels on the poster. I do think this, for me, again, goes to the thing. It's kind of the theme of Chatting Between Takes. It's not on purpose, but everything for me comes back to, am I lugging around too much of yesterday to enjoy today? Am I so like, if only people would see Barn Wedding in the right theater, or the right light or whatever. It's like, no, we're going to get a real good crack in the next few months and we're going to get it seen. And whatever happens is the best of that scenario is what we're going to take, or what I'm going to take. Or maybe not. Maybe I hold out because I realize that, oh, you know, again, everything I say may be wrong. I think festivals are maybe more important than ever, Dennis, is really what I'm getting at, because of the amount of content, and the festivals are already weeding you out. So distributors already have their eye on you the moment you're accepted somewhere. So I don't know. That's just my experience. I was sort of shocked at how many publicists and how distributors started contacting us and that kind of thing. And, you know, they're trolling. They're trolling for content. They're trolling for a good poster. They're trolling for content. And it's so hard to get good content out there. I posted this on Facebook. You know, I won't find the specific thing, but I did this play called Liver. And we got all the best reviews I've ever gotten in my life for a piece. But it wasn't for me. I mean, my reviews were categorically good, which I really appreciate. You know, I put my heart and soul into this performance, and it was a role worthy of knocking out of the park. But one thing that was so phenomenal is everybody was categorically well-received and categorically excellent. And the reviews reflected it. Now, look, reviews aren't the be-all, end-all. But when every single review is 4 stars and every single review describes the play the same way, the performance is the same way, the strengths, you know, at a certain point, that to me is listening to the world. This thing worked. And In the past, I would have wanted to be the best thing in a bad production. I really would have. I hate to admit it. But my ego was such that I'd rather be singled out, as you know, the best captain of a ship that sank, assuming I can get on the lifeboat. Because to me, the lifeboat is being singled out. And that's something that's changed for me. You know, Barn Wedding got Best Ensemble. The play I did, directed, got Best Production at a festival. And then this thing was just roundly, you know, we were all promoted. And maybe it's because I'm 40. Maybe it's because I trust a bit more, not entirely, but a lot more than when I was younger, that I have a career and that I know how to do what I'm doing, even though I still always second guess that I'm any good at it. It's the one thing is I can second guess it while not letting it run the show. And again, this goes to everything we're talking about. I am afraid I'm not that good an actor. I am afraid that my career is going to end the 31st when my last day on the Girlfriend Experience happens. By the way, it's possible. There's no guarantee I'll ever get hired again. No guarantee a volcano we don't know exists below Toronto won't entomb us in ash. Look it up. It happened. The Last Days of Pompeii. That was a TV movie. The Last Days of Pompeii. I think that might have been a two-nighter. God, that was good. TV movies, I wonder if people watch them the way they used to. Well, the way I used to. I mean, TV movies were an event. I used to love TV movies. And part of it is I love television as much as film. And, you know, there were TV movie actors. Hell, maybe I even am one. I don't know. I think I am, maybe. And they were good. And the gloss wasn't as good. And the editing wasn't as good. But they were excellent entertainment. I used to love them. I don't know if they make movies in that same way. I think they maybe do. You know, I just did a Lifetime one called Kept Woman. And I think when I look at how people responded to it, they're responding the way I used to respond to, like, the kind of horror TV movie that happened at the top of a ski hill, or that one when a stranger calls. Is that what it's called? Man, that was freaky. Hold on. Have you checked the children? Oh my God, this was one of the scariest movies I've ever seen in my life. I was four when it was released. 18 scariest horror movie opening scenes ranked. Was this a TV movie? Oh, I don't know if this was a TV movie or not. Maybe it wasn't. Maybe this was theatrical. It used to play on TV. See, I don't even know. Because again, back in the day, I'm not seeing a horror movie when I'm four in the theater. So then it's on TV with commercials, probably edited for content. And I used to have this joke. No one else thought it was funny. Where if I was, you know, on a plane and it would say, this movie has been edited to fit your screen, I'd be like, oh, great, they're cutting out all the swearing. No one ever laughed. Probably because, A, when you're on an airplane and you have headphones on, you're not actually all watching the same movie. So, you know, you may as well just be shuffling along Queen Street going, screw you, Gordon. And everyone looks around and there's nobody with you. I don't yell at Gordon often. Screw you, Gordon. I will find you, Gordon. And I will kill you. We're getting there. We are getting there. But yeah, so I... the joke, by the way, you know what? I'm not going to explain the joke. Anybody who can explain the joke to me gets a Chatting Between Takes mug. We got to get those mugs. Oh, man. We got to get those mugs. So really, look, with the liver thing, with the play, it's almost scary how much better it is to be a part of something good. And by the way, a good part of something good. Than to be excellent in something bad. And where the trick really comes is that I really wasn't that excellent in the things I thought I was. You know, I mean, look, I have a career, so I must be okay at what I do. Because in my line of work, you just don't after a while. You got to be good at something. And by the way, this is even something I've learned. I used to look at people and be so judgmental. And A, it's because I was afraid. So I had to create a system of thinking that made me better than them, in spite of all evidence. My first TV show, The Associates, I decided I was the best actor on the show in the first season. I fucking decided this, people. I did some good work. I did some bad work. I did some okay work. I'm not better than anyone else on that show. And by the way, it was my first ever time on television. Why would I be that good? If we get good at what we do and we get good at how we do it, I had done zero of it. I meet zero of my own requirement except for the acting part. But I promise you this. Working for the wrong medium, if you apply metalworking skills to wood, you may be great at metalwork and they may have some things in common so that you can laterally move in. But I had never, I'd acted a lot, but never on television. So I was working metal and TV was wood and not all of it played. Now, by the time I figured out some of the technical aspects, all those acting years I'd spent on stage did catch up, and I do believe I've catapulted, you know, there's a skill and an ability there that comes from that, but the translation hadn't happened yet. Some days it did, some days it didn't. My point is this. Three out of us five leads got nominated for Geminis the first year, and I wasn't one of them. And so guess what my ego had to do? Was figure out even more ways that I was better than everyone. Figure out even more ways the judging was flawed. Figure out even more ways that, you know, the wrong clip got sent. Now, by the way, granted, most people aren't watching the show. They're watching a one scene clip that gets sent to them, and characters are not built in a scene. So there isn't zero truth to these justifications. There never is zero truth. The problem is that the justification may be based on a fact, can be used to justify something else not true, and you build up enough of those, and you've got a pretty good-looking reason for something that's actually a bunch of BS, and all it is ego serving itself, because the very thing that the human wants, connection, feeling of belonging, feeling of comfort, the ego wants the opposite. It wants isolation. It wants me to feel entitled so that I will take from you. It wants me to basically be inhuman. And that's the thing, you know, is when I rant about this technology and all this stuff, all I'm trying to do, even though I'm so grateful that it lets us connect, and I mean that, you know, I mean that, I value this, is just trying to be more human. Just, I don't know what that means. I do know that selfies don't feel human to me. Doesn't mean I'm going to stop taking them. I'm just maybe going to mitigate taking them. I'm going to explore not take it. You know, stuff like that. There's doctors who are literally devoting their lives to working on cancer cures. There's four-year-olds who've had cancer since they were two and are blind and are trying to learn how to speak and walk in this city. And we're out trying to get as many likes on Instagram as possible. That feels weird to me. It does feel weird to me. Doesn't mean I'm going to stop, but I am going to work in that direction because I don't want to live that detached from something human. It feels very inhuman to be doing that. Doesn't mean I have to use that as a way to connect with everybody's pain and then be in pain and moan myself. I can be a very positive or very happy person in spite of somebody else's illness, or maybe even to serve in some way. I don't know. I really don't know, by the way. I was reading something today about a group of pre-millennials, and what is it called? Something about the Oregon Trail. I really enjoyed this article. It really got me thinking. So this is interesting for me. My brother is Gen X. He was born in 1970. Gen X, to me, having been there for it, it's a real specific thing. You know, it reality bites and singles, and you know, that really encapsulated the whole Gen X thing. I'd be Gen Y, even though, by the way, if you look up any online definition of Gen X, it's me. But to anybody who's my age, we all kind of know that we weren't Gen X. We might have pretended because Gen X was cool for a while, but I was too young to really relate to what the messages of those, you know, Gen X representative things were. I was there for them and I was a young adult for them, but it wasn't my experience. Gen Y was. Gen Y2K, basically, which is different than a millennial. millennials are what's going on now, I guess, but, and I'm sure some millennial will be like, no, now it's whatever. But I'll say this, this Oregon Appalachian Trail, and this is my point. Let me look this up right now. Hold on. Oregon computer game online. Anyways, it talks about a certain generation, and it says if you were born sort of mid-late 70s. And it's so funny how these generations work. I missed it. Because the way it was describing like being at college and getting on AOL, the Oregon Trail generation. And it says here, if you were born, well, tail end of the 70s. Okay, that makes sense because that's 4 years later than me. And it says here, some generational experts lazily glob someone from the late 70s onto Gen X. Yes, it's lazy. And by the way, this is what's interesting. Somebody in the comments section is like, well, Gen X even being only like 10 years is too short because generations are 18 years or something. It's like, what are you talking about? Generations are like 5 years. Seriously, because Gen X is not a 1975er because like I say, I would never assert I'm Gen X. And then this Oregon Trail generation, let's assume that's a real thing. That's after me. That is absolutely after me. I would definitely be like a Y2K-er because I was already out of college and living when that whole Y2K.com, you know, I'd be the .com generation for sure. And it's all very different and very specific. And the reason I was thinking about this, who cares? But this Oregon Trail thing's lost on me. And the idea of being at college and like immediately logging onto your computer. No, like we didn't have internet. We had intra-university emails that no one used. We were still on the phone people and hope they had an answering machine system. Nobody had cell phones when I was at university and nobody had AOLs. So I miss that generation. And that description of how your day would go is really important because how your day goes is very much that generation you're a part of. So if my day goes totally different than the Oregon Trail generation for most of my life because of the technological identification, and it doesn't just have to be technological, cultural or whatever. But so that's one of those things where I imagine that must be what it was like if you were at Vietnam or at Woodstock or in World War II, you know, where we have created this picture of the past that's probably wholly inaccurate. It's probably not even close. And because it's real easy to just go, oh yeah, that's what Vietnam was like. Well, no, what was it like for the people there? Yeah, that's what the hippie generation was like. And so then I, as a lover of all these historical things, be like, oh man, in Toronto, it's like, oh, Rochdale College must have been blah, blah, blah. And you run into a guy who's been there and they're like, yeah. And I've got this youthful exuberance about something that's not even remotely accurate. And I can just imagine, I mean, there'd be no reason for someone to interview me about Gen Y. But if somebody was like, hey, Sean, we want to interview you, you know, we're doing this thing and you're Gen X, right? I'd be like, yeah, we can do the interview, but no, I'm not. And maybe that's what the interview should be about. Because, anyways, Wikipedia, they got my weight wrong too. Ayo! Ayo, ladies and gentlemen, the sun is peeking out. It's so great to be back with you, chatting between takes. We've been all over the map today, and I don't care. I don't care. I don't care. I will find you. I have a very special set. We're not even going to keep going. I don't know what's going on with my throat today. I thought my voice was fine. June 2nd, 7:15 p.m., Grauman's Chinese Theater. Come on out and support the thing. By the way, if you happen to be a Chatting Between Takes fan who doesn't know me personally and you come out to this film, do it. We'll take some selfies. Follow me on Instagram, Sean M. Benson, Sean with a U. And we will take some selfies and we will post them and we'll say, you know what? Fuck it. We're going rebel tonight. We're trying for authenticity, but just one night on this red carpet, we're going to blow up the Twitter sphere. We're going to blow up the Insta sphere or not. Maybe you'll come up and want a selfie and I'll be in a bad mood that night and go, what are you doing? Haven't you been listening?
Haven't you been listening? Haven't you heard a word I've said?
Nobody sees me. Nobody knows me. We're going to jump back online real soon with our next app and love you guys all. Hope you're enjoying the spring as much as I have. I really feel bad for you if you live in a place that has no winter. Yeah, you sunny and 72 year rounders are really feeling bad right now about all the Porsche track days you've run in the winter while I've been up here staring online at things I think I need to buy because my car's in the garage. And so I think I need to retool the whole thing until I drive it for a few Ks and go, maybe I don't need to buy anything for it. Maybe that's just a way to vicariously feel like I'm part of it, even though I should just be out cross-country skiing or enjoying the winter instead of wishing it away while pretending I love the winter and that I am the North. Wow. Oh, it's 9th and Hennepin. And the moon casts a shadow over all this. The girl behind the counter has a tattooed deer. One for every year he's away, she says. There's nothing wrong with her that $100 wouldn't fix. It won't be hard. Write me on Facebook or Insta, who that is. Free chatting between takes mug. Love you guys all. Welcome back. And that's a wrap.